Hello, and welcome to Trashy Divorces, everybody's favorite good podcast about bad relationships. This week, though, a good relationship, maybe with some fallout, certainly famous in its own time. My name is Stacy, and Alicia, you are extremely excited about this one.
Oh, that I am. Welcome, friends. Thank you for joining us for today's Tale of Marital Misadventure with a Twist. Today, I'm bringing you the spiderweb-laden-filled story of Marion Davies, the most famous mistress of the 20th century. Marion Davies and W.R. Hearst carried...
William Randolph Hearst.
Oh yeah, carried on a multi-decade love affair. W.R. will never leave his long-suffering wife, Millicent. But even a wife didn't slow W.R. and Marion down all that much. This one is such a great story that we are double dipping. We're actually going to release this episode both on Trashy Divorces and Done and Done. Trash Pandas, you're going to adore it. Lots of connections in this one. For my Done and Done investigators, there is a reason I'm going into all of it for you. There are going to be a few follow-up episodes that launch from this particular story that I can't wait to tell you about. So many spiderwebs, but it really does all connect in our very, very tiny trashy world. Before we begin today with the lovely Marion, we do have a magic mirror here to give some huge shout-outs. First up, big, big thanks to Melanie Sean, our dearest friend, who did the incredible research for this story. Melanie, you are a goddess of all things old Hollywood, and I adore your trashy heart.
Next up, huge thanks and praise to our newest Patreon supporters. Alicia, whose names do we see in the magic mirror?
Holy cats, big love and thanks to Allison P., Julia P., Emily R., Sharon L.,
SOL 88, or Soul 88, not sure, PV, Erica R., Nasha H.,
and some new super supporters too, Carrie A., Sasha M., and Patricia. We cannot thank all of y'all enough. So grateful to our Patreon community, new and sustaining. Y'all are the magic, and we are so grateful for your support.
Patreon.com/trashydivorces is the place to go to find out all about extra trash candy that could be yours. Today, there is no time to waste.
Marion Davies and W.R. Hearst. Let's investigate and go, go, go.
All right, Alicia, this is the story of a media tycoon, and the heart wants what the heart wants, yes?
The heart really does want what the heart wants. This is a little different. Nary a divorce with our profilees here, but as Marion Davies said, love is not always created at the altar. Love doesn't need a wedding ring.
I feel like she would say that.
Marion Davies, legendary. She made 46 films. Hmm. In her lifetime, but the role that she is best known for is one role that she actually did not play on screen. This would be Susan Alexander, the no-talent wife of a publishing magnate in Orson Welles' masterpiece, Citizen Kane. The enduring cultural impact of Citizen Kane, combined with the fact that the vast majority of Marion's films were silent films, little seen by successive generations, sort of give us this impression, and it's completely false, that Marion Davies' career was nothing more than a rich man's vanity project. Untrue. Of course, the rich man in question here was one William Randolph Hearst, one of the inspirations for the titular character in Citizen Kane. And though, to be fair, Hearst did use his considerable resources to promote Marion's career, even Orson Welles later admitted that the real Marion bore little resemblance to the fictional Susan. This next bit is from Orson Welles in the foreword of Marion's own memoirs called The Times We Had. Welles says, "Kane picked up Susan on a street corner from nowhere where the poor girl herself thought she belonged. Marion Davies was no dim shop girl. She was a famous beauty who had her choice of rich, powerful, and attractive beau. before Hearst sent his first bouquet to her stage door. That Susan was Kane's wife and Marion was Hearst's mistress is a difference more important that might be guessed in today's changed climate of opinion. The wife was a puppet and a prisoner. The mistress was never less than a princess. Unlike her presumed doppelganger, Marion was neither a dilettante, nor was she a wife. Marion was, undoubtedly, hands down, the most famous mistress of her day. Though Orson Welles was noted for many talents, contrition is not very high up on that list.
Mm-hmm.
Please see part one of my Trashy Divorces from Rita Hayworth. We'll be following up with part two in short order. But here, in a rare moment of humility for Orson Welles, he does publicly apologize for the damage he personally did to Marion's legacy through that film. Orson Welles will say, "As one who shares much of the blame for casting another shadow, the shadow of Susan Alexandra Kane, I rejoice in this opportunity to record something which today is all but forgotten, except for those lucky enough to have seen a few of her pictures. Marion Davies was one of the most delightfully accomplished comedians in the whole history of screen. She would have been a star if Hearst had never happened. She was also a delightful and very considerable person." I want you to remember that. She would have been a star even without William Randolph Hearst. Marion Davies had it going on. In researching her story, it does involve some unique challenges. Why? Her beau, her sweetheart, William Randolph Hearst, didn't just have enough money to control the press. He owned the press.
He was the press, yeah.
So how do you get to maybe what is the real story and maybe what isn't the real story? Orson Welles, once again, will observe, "By the 70s, people started calling Marion Davies and William Randolph Hearst the Jackie and Airy of their day." But as Orson Welles pointed out in his foreword to Marion's memoir, the truth is that Hearst was never rich in the way Onassis was rich, and the power of Onassis resided solely in his money. He could buy himself an airline, an island, or a Greek colonel, but his place in history is recorded largely in the gossip columns. Hearst published the gossip column. He practically invented them. The difference is immense.
Yeah, what's the old saying? Never argue with someone who buys ink by the barrel.
Something like that. At the time of her death, the New York Times will eulogize Marion this way. "Once upon a time, there lived in Brooklyn a lovely young maiden with a slight stutter, whose mother must have been a student of Colette, for the first and most telling lesson she and her three older sisters learned at mother's knee was to go straight for the dough, and to hell with all that nonsense about young men and romance. And because mother always knew best, they all followed this simple game plan, with the result that they all came to live lives well above the median standard of their day. But Marion, the stutterer, did better than that. She strove so successfully that before she died in 1961 at the age of 64, she had shattered all known records for haterism, both past and present. Whatever the official wages of sin, Miss Davies wound up with holdings estimated to be worth in excess of $20 million, a reward for love unlikely to be topped under the present tax structure." Oh, I just love this story. Okay, let's talk about once upon a time in Brooklyn. Little Marion was born. Marion was born Marion Cecilia Doris, the youngest child of Bernard and Rose. By the time Marion recorded her memoirs in the early 1950s, she was telling people she had been born in 1905. However.
Yeah, seems not likely.
Marion was really born January 3rd, 1897, Capricorn lady, in Prospect Park, Brooklyn. Marion, not from the wrong side of the tracks. No little match girl here. She grows up in Gramercy Place. Her father, Marion's dad, was a city magistrate, and her grandfather was a district attorney. Marion claimed Grandpa owned two whole blocks of New York City real estate from 12th to 14th Street, as well as an enormous place and a stable of racehorses in Saratoga.
So comfortable.
Very comfortable. Now, Marion is not the first Davies in the Doris family. Her sister will adopt the name Davies first, Renee. Renee was a showgirl who copped her stage name from this real estate sign that she would pass during her commute in from Long Island. Fun fact about this particular real estate sign, the agent that was promoted, J. Clarence Davies, had a son named Valentine who grows up to be a Hollywood screenwriter. Valentine Davies wins an Oscar for a little film he wrote called Miracle on 34th Street.
Tiny little world.
You don't even know how tiny it is by the time we get to the end of this story. Marion will eventually follow her older sisters into show business. Not only Renee, but her other older sister, Rosemary. And Marion is attracting scads of, what do they say, wealthy stage door Johnnies. She's kind of a hit. Marion will later say, that's how it is when you're on stage. You get admirers and proposals of marriage or something. It doesn't matter what your face looks like. It's all how you look from across the footlights. And every girl in a show looks glamorous to the audience. Of all the stage doors in town, it is one of those audience members that will soon capture Marion Davies. Who is that?
Stage door Johnny William Randolph Hearst.
You got it.
The only time in his life he was referred to as a stage door Johnny.
Let's go ahead and enter W.R. into our picture. W.R. was born into a wealthy California family, born April 29th, 1863.
Wow, I was going to ask if, like, I figured there was an age difference. That's a lot.
Oh, yeah. Big, big age difference. Hearst is often credited or blamed for the American involvement in the Spanish-American War. He was a proponent in his younger years of progressive causes, which is a little odd because the older he gets, get off of my lawn, he'll begin to become very conservative, promoting American isolationism before World War II, even opposing FDR with his entire network of newspapers, magazines, radio stations. He had a lot of business interests, but publishing is W.R.'s passion. Marion later explains the papers came first, the magazines came next. He didn't really bother about the gold or the silver mines or the paper mills. After all, he paid the experts to run them. As Hearst biographer David Nassau explained, he built the nation's first media conglomerate by acquiring or establishing newspapers in nearly all the country's largest cities. New York, Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore, Boston, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Milwaukee, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, and Seattle.
This is such an interesting week to be telling this story.
Isn't
honestly.
It, though? And then expanding his holdings horizontally into magazines, moving pictures, and radio. He published Cosmopolitan, which was then a popular general interest magazine, as well as Good Housekeeping, Town and Country, House Beautiful, and Harper's Bazaar. He operated his own news service, his own syndicated feature and comic strip services, and the most successful Sunday newspaper supplement, American Weekly. He was a pioneer in newsreels and feature films. He produced, for example, The Perils of Pauline in 1914, and in 1919, he founded Cosmopolitan Pictures in New York. It was one of the largest movie factories on the East Coast. In the late 20s and early 30s, he took on the new medium of radio and eventually controlled 13 stations in many of the markets where he owned newspapers. Legendary. I mean, there's no diminishing his influence. He was the guy.
Sure. This is also, he's the guy, and this is why, you know, Congress regulated this industry at a certain point.
100%.
That is a lot of editorial influence.
Well, with Hearst as the guy, right, he will establish his own brand of personal journalism. I'm going to leave out professional and just say personal. Hearst sets the topics. He sets the tone. He edits the editorials. He will write major opinion pieces himself and will display them prominently where? Front page.
Yep.
He proudly proclaims that while the other newspapers merely reported the news, his papers made the news. Did you know that William Randolph Hearst was elected to Congress?
I did not.
Not once, but twice. In 1903 and 1907. In between those years.
Wherever did he find the time?
In between those years. In 1905, when he Wright wasn't reelected, Hearst unsuccessfully runs for New York City mayor. That was 1905. After that, didn't work.
And what did the Hearst papers make endorsements?
I bet they did. The year after that, 1906, Hearst completed another unsuccessful political run, this one for the governor of New York.
All right.
Hearst isn't quite done. He's going to rally one more time. He gives it one more shot in 1909 to run again for New York City mayor, not elected. After 1909, Hearst has put his political ambitions to rest. He's just going to do it through his immense brand and influence with everything people read.
I was going to say, he's certainly in his business life far more powerful than a congressman or even a mayor of New York City.
Oh, yeah. So Marion will later say about this time, because Hearst is done with this by, you know, the 1910s. Marion says, I didn't know Mr. Hearst then, but he always sat in the front row of the Follies. The girls in the show told me who he was. They said, look out for him. He's looking at you. He's a wolf in sheep's clothing. He's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
I think he was a wolf in wolf's clothing, but okay, go ahead.
So early teens, right? Marion, old enough to be in the Follies. You want to hear the age difference breakdown? Marion was 18. Mm-hmm. Hearst was 52. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, though, the age difference was not the biggest obstacle to their budding romance. What could be standing in the way? Well, it seems like the biggest obstacle was yet another showgirl, the one William Randolph Hearst had married in 1903.
I was going to say, don't tell me it's another showgirl. The man has a wife, but okay.
Yeah, she, Millicent, was a showgirl.
So he had been a stage door Johnny before.
Yes, decades a stage door Johnny. By the time that Hearst meets Marion, his wife, Millicent, and William Randolph Hearst had not one, not two, not three, not four, but five sons, including Randolph Apperson, who will grow up to be Patty Hearst's father, previous Trashy Divorces alum.
Yep.
According to the Hearst biographer, David Nassau, by the spring of 1916, the tycoon and the Corrine were seeing each other regularly at parties and dinners. Seeking to be discreet for the sake of his wife, a former chorus girl who refused to grant him a divorce, Hearst tried to lead a double life. He fooled no one. Let's go ahead and take a quick break here, and then we're going to shuffle into a very modern romance where everybody just quits trying to fool anybody.
Excellent. We'll be right back.
Poor Millicent.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Millicent just married. But here comes Marion, and WR is not going to be stopped.
Right, yeah, and she's sitting home with five young boys to take care of. Jeez.
Millicent's, I'm never going to give you a divorce. Hearst is like, all right, I'll lead a double life. And so he did. He fooled no one. Hearst will leave Millicent in their five-floor penthouse on New York's Upper East Side and just begin conducting his affair with Marion just right out in the open. A social gambit that very few public figures could pull off in the early 20th century.
For sure. It helps to own all the papers and all the radio stations and all the writers and all the...
It was is going to lead you to that next assumption. Mm-hmm. How did he get away with it? He controls the press. His power, Hearst, was able to insulate the couple from the kind of backlash that your previous TD alum, Ingrid Bergman, would experience decades later. Remember, Ingrid Bergman vilified for conceiving a child out of wedlock with Roberto Rossellini. Do you know that Marion Davies was one of the very few people in Hollywood who publicly supported Ingrid Bergman?
Hmm. Yeah. That makes sense, though.
No, Marion Davies is one swell dame, and I don't think she gets anywhere near enough credit. Marion recalls, "The only open attack on living in sin, being a mistress and all that, was from Al Smith when he was campaigning for something or another. He made a stump speech. And then W.R. wrote an article and said he had no respect for a man who would do that." Now, Marion undoubtedly benefited from her association with W.R. But even the nastiest, meanest bystanders would agree that Marion just wasn't in it for the money. She'll say, "I like to think that W.R. was at his happiest when he was with me. That's a very conceited thing to say, but we always did have a good time. I'd be sewing, he'd be working. We'd have an occasional conversation. With a great long friendship and love, you don't have to talk. You're perfectly contented to know that somebody's just there. That means a lot, that complete tranquility."
Mm-hmm. Not endorsing, like, ditching your ex-wife and publicly cavorting, but I mean, you know, things happen in life.
Well, I think, right, he's the man. There's no arguing with him. So here Millicent and W.R. have five boys. What do you think the sons have to learn how to do with the quickness? If we want a relationship with our dad, we're going to have to play nice with Marion. Of those five boys, her sons, Marion says, "George was the oldest son and the smartest. He was the first one to be nice to me. Then Bill came. Afterwards, everything was all right. I suppose they didn't do it for any other reason except they knew who held the money bags. They realized that their mother wouldn't give them a cent, so they had to rely on their father. But they used a little diplomacy."
That's so complicated. Because you know...
Oh, yeah.
You know Millicent is like, "Listen, boys, yeah, this is weird and horrible. Just be nice. Just go be nice. I do not control the purse strings in this family."
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. It's up to your dad. And Millicent just kind of went and lived her own completely different, extraordinary life, completely away from W.R. Like, it's an open secret. Everybody knows. And even though they're not hiding their relationship, Hearst and Marion don't necessarily flaunt it either. They're not trying to be mean about it, but they're going to be together, so say what you want. Hearst's biographer points out, "They seldom appeared together in public and were almost never photographed side by side, even at San Simeon. Although the arrangement was clearly painful for Millicent, she made the best of it by keeping her distance. 3,000 miles. They didn't really have any formal parting of ways," says their son, William Randolph Hearst Jr. "There was no announcement. There was no divorce. There were no proceedings. There wasn't anything. There was just that Pop was spending way more time away from home out in Los Angeles." I don't think Paul Simon covered that one in 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Maybe. Just get on the other coast, Hearst. So with no need to hide their association or necessarily flaunt their association, the one thing William Hearst was free to do was promote Marion's career, which he will do with zeal and gusto. This is a quote from the LA Times. "In May of 1916, a story in the Hearst-owned New York American revealed that Davies had been the first of the new Follies beauty crop to be selected by Mr. Ziegfeld for his upcoming show. After that, news items about Davies began appearing regularly in the Hearst papers." Davies' first film role was in the 1917 Runaway Romany. This film was actually directed by her brother-in-law, George Lederer. All these names, I promise, on the Done and Done side will come back around. Marion later says, "I couldn't act, But the idea of silent pictures appealed to me because I couldn't talk either. Silent pictures were right up my alley, and that's how I got all the bad notices, except for the ones that Hearst columnist Luella Parsons wrote.
There you go.
Oh, W.R., he's in love, and when you're in love, you spend money on some things, and Hearst spares no expense when it comes to promoting Marion.
Yeah, and when you are historically significant gossip columnist Luella Parsons, you kind of do what the boss says.
That's exactly right. Hearst will buy a theater especially for the opening of one of Marion Davies' films. A film called Little Old New York. He'll just buy a theater for it. Eventually, Marion and Hearst will make their way out to Hollywood. But not before W.R. makes Marion a woman of independent means. Marion says, I'd been working for Hearst in New York, and he had turned the Cosmopolitan Film Company over to me. Then he made a contract for me at MGM, and my salary was very good. It amounted to about $500,000 a year. But it was too much money because my ability was not equal to it at all. He had said, I guess I'm putting all my eggs in one basket, and I was the basket. Marion Davies will go on to make about 2 films a year for MGM for the next decade, earning her salary plus half the profits of those films.
That seems like an unusual arrangement for MGM at the time.
Late 1910s, early 1920s, silent film, like it's Wild West.
Yeah, but they weren't typically handing over half the profits to an actress.
Of her time at MGM, Marion later said, I had lots of fun at MGM and no problems because they had figured out that I was either sort of an idiot or that I had a protector. They never argued with me. Besides, I know, isn't this fascinating?
Yeah. It's extremely self-aware. I appreciate that very much.
She's such an angel. Trashy angel, that girl. I love her. Besides the power of the press, Marion brought to MGM a prestige of the parade of prominent visitors whom she entertained at lavish luncheons in her ready 5,000 square foot dressing room on the MGM lot.
I'm thinking of the square footage of our house. Like, I don't even know what to do with this information.
4 times the size of our house.
Yeah.
Okay. As the editors
I think they worked out who she was with.
I had a protector. I was the basket. As her editors of her memoir point out, Marion was indeed a unique movie star. Without the support of W.R., she had financing and promotional opportunities. She could pay for extra scenes in her films and for the extra niceties of life, and she did. Marion, Trashy Angel, spoke of her career with a little bit of self-deprecation and some sly wit. Mm-hmm. She will say, W.R. argued with millions of people. He thought I could do anything. Shakespeare's plays, any sort of part. He thought I was the best. There were quite a lot of people who didn't have that same theory. Marion was game up to a point. A few fun things. Charlie Chaplin, previous TD alum, was Marion's stand-in for a scene set in a lion's den with actual lions. This film is called Xander the Great. You know, you watch old films and you're like, how did you make that stunt happen?
That's incredible effect.
No, they were real lions. Let's see. She'll say, but they thought up more stunts for me. They wanted me to ride backwards on a bicycle when I couldn't even ride forwards. It was a story that was mixed up with the West and the circus. They said it was funny, but George Hill, the director, committed suicide a little while after.
Oh my God.
I hope it was not because of the picture.
Oh, poor. Wow, everyone in that.
So let's talk about Hearst's involvement in Marion's career for as much as it may have jump-started it. Proved sometimes to be a very double-edged sword. He was very willing to invest in her work, but W.R. is so rose-colored glasses over her that he cannot really evaluate her strengths as a performer without
The influence of his rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, what word am I...
love goggles.
Okay.
Yeah. You're the greatest in the world, but yeah.
Greatest in the world. And the thing is, Marion has innate talent for comedy. She is funny, 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 and she loves to do it.
I mean, I'm getting that from her writing about herself, like, clearly.
But W.R. wants to cast her in these historical epics,
sure,
that are all very serious and very droll. Like, think about silent films. Mm-hmm. If you are funny, like, think about if you've got a comedic bent and how you can show that in a silent film besides these dour historical roles,
zoom
right?
Zoom in on the eyes. Yeah.
He's not putting her in films that are really showcasing her
strengths,
best talents. Mm-hmm. W.R. also really seemed determined to brand Marion as another Mary Pickford, another silent star, big, huge. Mm-hmm. But Mary Pickford was known for playing prepubescent girls all the way into her 20s.
Not disturbing. Okay.
Marion Davies later says, Mary Pickford never made anything that was the slightest bit sexy. Neither did Shirley Temple, but I couldn't compare to them. I tried my best to follow in their tracks, but an imitator is always a poor example.
Hmm.
Part of the reason, maybe, that W.R. adopts this strategy, perhaps he doesn't want to let Marion mature into roles that would cast her as a wife and mother, since he's not able to give her those experiences off screen. But Marion troops on, among other roles in this historical thing. Marion Davies plays Mary Tudor.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. In When Knighthood Was in Flower. She'll also star in a movie called 5 and 10 that was based on the life of Barbara Hutton. Mm-hmm. Though many film historians have dismissed Marion's films as box office losers, that's not what the box office tallies recall. Operating reports from the studio do show that most of her films made money. In the end, it wasn't the profits, but instead the interpersonal relations that eventually compelled Marion and Hearst to end their association with MGM. This happens on a little film called Marie Antoinette.
Jones.
Marion will later say, Marie Antoinette was the straw that broke the camel's back at MGM. W.R. wanted me to do it, and I was going to try my best. I wasn't sure I could make the grade, but I had read all the histories about Marie Antoinette and went through the whole routine, and I could visualize myself as Marie Antoinette with a big white wig and an upturned nose. He had wanted me to play Juliet, but the studio said no.
Like Romeo and Juliet?
Correct. Yeah. They said no Juliet for Marion. She's a comedian. The same thing happened with the Barretts of Wimpole Street. I couldn't be the sick, consumptive Elizabeth Browning because they said Marion's too lively. She's got to do comedy. I was frustrated at each end. W.R. was much more mad than I was. I said, I don't want you to have anything more to do with the MGM studio. We went down that road, but fast. MGM goes by the wayside and they take Marion's 14-room dressing room with them. It's okay. They just dismantle it.
Yeah, 5,000 square feet. We can put that to other use.
No, Marion goes and just reassembles the thing at Warner Brothers in Burbank.
Okay.
It's fine. Marion will say, I don't think Louis B. Mayer minded losing me so much. He did mind losing Mr. Hearst, if you know what I mean. Later, he said to me, we have lost our queen. What he meant was he had lost the power of the chess game, the visitors, and the press.
I was going to say, I'm sure that all of these, maybe not awesome movies, were getting glowing write-ups in the Hearst papers.
You know they were.
Mm-hmm.
Set MGM on the map. I mean, this is the heyday of MGM.
Mm-hmm.
Marion will go on to make a few more films at Warner Brothers before retiring from acting at the age of 40. She'll say, I just didn't want to work in pictures anymore. I'd been working awfully hard for quite a long time. At that time, Mr. Hearst was about 78 or so. and I felt he needed companionship.
Mm-hmm.
He was having some financial troubles at the time, too, and he was more upset than people realized. I thought the least I could do for a man who had been so wonderful and great, one of the greatest men ever, was to be a companion to him. Want a little real estate spiderweb?
Oh, I do.
After Marion retired, her infamous bungalow was moved yet again, this time to Benedict Canyon, where her dressing room, now moved from MGM
to Warner Brothers,
now to Benedict Canyon, was sold and used as a private home. One of its residents, who used it as a bachelor pad after his trashy divorce from his first wife, Louis B. Mayer.
Ironic.
He'll be coming back around over on the Dun and Dun side. I promise there's a reason for my investigators. I'm putting this one out. I'm planting some seeds on the side. Goodness. We're going to go ahead and take another quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about life on screen and off with Marion and Hearst.
Can't wait. We'll be right back.
So what was the life of Marion Davies and William Randolph Hearst like? We hear, right, oh, infamous affair, famous mistress, May, December, love story. But let's see, like, what their day-to-day would have been. When they are not working, because Hearst, obsessed with publishing, Marion, acting, they were either shopping or entertaining. Hearst owned several properties around the world. Let's talk about probably the most famous of those, San Simeon. This was a castle, legit castle, north of Los Angeles. You ready for some of the fun bennies that San Simeon had? 60 guest bedrooms. 60.
Well, for entertaining.
A zoo.
For entertaining.
Housing. Lions, tigers, leopards, honey bears, spider monkeys, camels, water buffalo, zebras, elk, emus, ostriches, and an elephant named after Marion.
Okay.
Marion later says she was very insulted by the elephant named after her.
Elephants are regal creatures, Marion.
The couple also has a Mediterranean-style mansion in Beverly Hills. Another fun spiderweb here. John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy visited that property on their honeymoon in 1953. John F. Kennedy later uses that property as his West Coast headquarters during the 1960 presidential campaign, with Frank Sinatra frequently playing bartender there. Perhaps its biggest claim to fame, though, was its cameo in that home, the home itself, along with the cameo of a horse's head in the film The Godfather.
Interesting.
Made by Robert Evans.
Oh, sure.
Portions also of the Whitney Houston film, The Bodyguard, were also filmed at this estate. It was recently listed, a few years ago. It was on the market for, you want to take a guess?
$40
million. $195
million. So a little more.
Marion also had an oceanfront compound in Santa Monica. They referred to as the Beach House. This is oceanfront right up the way from the beach house of Patricia Kennedy Lawford and Peter Lawford, and the home that Dominic Dunn and Lenny Dunn moved into when they first arrived in Hollywood that they rented from Harold Lloyd.
I'm guessing this one's finally sort of a modest little bungalow on the beach that's okay.
With a name like the Beach House, you'd think it's a little shack, a little salt box thing.
Three, four rooms. Probably a nice kitchen, though. You want to, you know, a lot of seafood, a lot of entertaining. Okay, tell me.
The main structure was a three-story U-shaped Georgian revival with his and her master suites connected by a hidden door. At least one room finished in gold leaf. And 37 fireplaces.
Wow.
The beach house
How cold does it get at the beach?
The beach house property also included four other houses on the property. All told.
Let's see.
The beach house, just the tiny beach house.
Little bungalow.
Had 110 bedrooms, 55 bathrooms, and a full staff of 30.
I think that Ken, whose job is beach, would not know what to do with this.
Of the Santa Monica Beach House, Marion said, WR liked the beach house, but that was when the architects came in again. More additions were added on. It almost got to be as big as the White House, bigger maybe. Just like you play with blocks, he added on, but little blocks wouldn't have cost the money. Now, it's one thing to build the house, right? It's, you have the house, but then to furnish the house?
Yeah.
Oh.
Your hundred and how many bedrooms?
Hearst furnished both San Simeon and the beach house. They didn't just go to like IKEA or whatever. They ended up going to Europe and just purchasing
all the beds.
Entire rooms.
All the beds.
Yes, of antiques. The basement bar in the beach house was a 1516 tavern from an inn at Surrey, England,
yeah.
That they just deconstructed and reconstructed on the beach.
Sure.
I mean, in the basement.
Like
but,
you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
According to the editors of Marion's memoir, in January 1960, Ocean House would be reduced to a parking lot. Marion then told reporters that she had spent over $7 million on the place during the 15 years she had used it. She sold the property in 1945 for only $600,000. And that was just about the cost of the 37 fireplaces that had been installed. Between 1945 and 1960, Ocean House was a private beach club and then a hotel. But its 30 bedrooms were not enough for profitability. So there was an auction, and then the wrecking crew moved in.
Hmm.
All right, there's a little bit of fun about your real estate. Let's talk about what was life like just for the parties, y'all. I love hearing these old stories and looking at the old pictures because Marion Davies is like, she's in the Hollywood system and WR controls it. Like, they're friends with everybody. Get a load of some of these spiderwebs. What happens at these homes before the wrecking ball comes in? Marion and Hearst entertained pretty much anyone who was anyone. David Nassau writes in The New Yorker, Hearst expected the world to come to him, and it did. Although San Simeon was half a day's journey from either San Francisco or Los Angeles, nobody turned down one of Hearst's and Marion Davies' invitations to spend a weekend at the ranch. Among their guests in the 20s and 30s were ex-president Calvin Coolidge, the British statesman Winston Churchill, men of letters such as George Bernard Shaw, Aldous Huxley, and H.G. Wells, celebrity aviators like Amelia Earhart and Charles Lindbergh, bankers and businessmen like A. Giannini of the Bank of America and J. Paul Getty, politicians and publishers and galore, and all the newly arrived lords and ladies of Hollywood. Whoo! Even Greta Garbo and Howard Hughes show up. You want to know what Marion has to say about old Howard Hughes, previous TD alum?
I very much do.
He was good company because he didn't talk too much.
Well, I bet Silent Cal Coolidge, too.
Here's a fun spiderweb. Marion had a little Dachshund puppy. That Dachshund puppy's name was Gandhi. And Gandhi really, really was very loyal to Marion until one other lady came along. That lady, poor little rich girl, Doris Duke. Marion says, I thought Gandhi would never leave me, but he followed Doris Duke continually. I decided he was after her money. She was richer than I.
She was kind of richer than everyone.
Little bit. Doris Duke, fascinating. I'm not done with her over on the done and done side. So this time, homes, all the people, you could have anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Marion says, at the slightest drop of the hat, any occasion at all, we'd say, let's make a costume party. And the telephone would start ringing and we'd get costumes sent up from Los Angeles. Carloads of people would arrive and musicians, extra chefs, all that sort of thing. It was really fun. WR loved costume parties. During one of these parties, Norma Shearer showed up dressed as Marie Antoinette, with Hedy Lamarr and Merle Oberon as ladies in waiting. Charles Boyer and Basil Rathbone dress up as ambassadors. Norma Shearer's skirt is so wide for how she dresses in costume for this just fun party with friends that an entire door had to be removed so she could get into the room. Now, old Hollywood, you know that Norma Shearer is the one who beat Marion Davies for the role of the doomed French queen in MGM's Marie Antoinette.
I did not know that.
Yes, so that's a little bit of elaborately staged shade, so to speak. 1937, Marion and W.R. host another party, this one a circus-themed party. What makes a circus-themed party even more fun? Let's borrow an entire merry-go-round from Warner Brothers for the occasion. A wall had to be torn down and put up again room for it.
Sure.
After the party, they returned the merry-go-round to the studio, but Marion loved it so much that she threw another party within a month. She'll say the merry-go-round was brought back and the hall was torn down and put up again. They tore that wall down and put it back in twice to get it in and out of there. WR didn't care about the expense at all. I would lose my mind to have a merry-go-round in my house. Every weekend, Marion says, we would have an orchestra in the ballroom and supper, a buffet for everyone. We'd only have 100 or 150 people in on a weekend.
I know.
I can barely handle two guests at a time. She goes on, we'd look at movies after dinner. We'd have a full show, a short and a newsreel and a feature picture. You want to hear some ironies of ironies here? Because this is really the part that I think is laughable. So WR, living in sin. He's 52, she's 18. They're hooked up from the mid-19 teens on. Hearst, having the most famous non-married mistress love affair that the world has ever seen, will not allow unmarried couples to go habitate under any of the roofs he has in his real estate holdings.
Except for one.
Marion later says plenty of romances started at San Simeon. There were watchmen around, so nobody could do anything off the beam.
That is so fascinating. Was he thinking that he could maintain cover for his own would-be scandal because he owned the papers? But if someone else got wrapped up in a scandal, it might...
He was pretty straight-laced. Like, you were stuck to one drink.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it was not... Yeah.
How did Jack Kennedy survive this?
Well, this was mostly during Prohibition.
Gotcha.
So, but everybody's still drinking, but he was like, nope, everybody gets one glass and then no more.
Interesting.
He's pretty bent on keeping that particular rule. That was a strict rule, Marion goes on. They had to be in their rooms at a certain hour and nobody could be in anybody else's room. WR was right in a way. There were young girls, and they could have gotten involved. The moonlight is very efficacious there. He had a place called the Cloister. It was way upstairs, and that was for the girls next to the library. The bachelors stayed in the duplexes. There was no connection. Let's not call it Presbyterian, but let's say he was very careful. And that was one good thing about it. Nobody stayed too long. That's only domestic, though. What happens non-stateside? Sometimes Hearst and Marion take their party on the road. They take annual trips to Europe. When they take those trips from Marion, she will say, they include 12 to 22 guests, and it got to be a routine. We would leave about the 1st of May or June. We'd get on a boat, and we always followed the same route. We'd get back in September or October.
Nice work if you can get it. I mean, that sounds amazing. We should all have that much money.
Quite a life, right?
Just going to go spend 4 or 5 months just annually. Just kicking around Europe. Why not?
We need to go take a bar from Surrey. We got to finish out that room that we took the wall down for the merry-go-round
for. We have to go to Belgium and purchase all of the beds in the country.
All of them.
I think that's known as the Great Belgian Bed Famine of 1934.
Coming this week on Trashy Royals. I'm just teasing. We're going to go ahead and take another break here. God, there's so many, many more good stories still just dripping on this Marion Davies tree. We'll be right back, y'all. Oh, the rumors of Hollywood. Let's go ahead and talk about one of the rumors that happened around Marion Davies, answering or attempting to answer the question, did the side piece have a side piece? Rumors still persist that Marion stepped out on her much older boyfriend with some other Hollywood notables, including Charlie Chaplin. Marion and Charlie Chaplin's perhaps alleged affair was immortalized in one of my favorite films from 2001 called The Cat's Meow. The Cat's Meow sort of dramatizes the pile of trash candy that posits that W.R. Hearst mistook the director Thomas Ince for Charlie Chaplin during an overnight trip on his yacht, and Hearst shot and killed Thomas Ince in a jealous rage of mistaken identity. Medical records provided by Ince's family later proves that he dies of natural causes. Neither Marion nor Chaplin ever admit to the affair. I'm going to put you just on pause there because that is a done and done follow-up that will be happening.
Okay.
According to Marion, though, she never had the opportunity nor the inclination to cheat on Hearst. She'll say there were some men who were a bit strenuous in their pursuit of me. That happened occasionally, but the moment W.R. would arrive, they'd all run for shelter. Nobody ever dared stand up to him, and I didn't ever give anybody any encouragement. I'd say hello, and that was as far as it ever went. It was quite romantic at San Simeon, and over a jigsaw puzzle, there'd be 5 or 6 people, and you'd look up and you'd see an eye looking at you. It was cute. Somebody might say something like, "You're divine," and such, but the moment W.R. would appear, whoosh, they'd disappear. Many of Marion's friends support her version of events. Her buddies are like, no, they were completely, no, it sounds silly, faithful to each other. I know how silly that sounds.
I mean, and yet.
But even if Marion had wanted to pursue something on the side, she's always surrounded by a cast of hundreds, either on the studio lot or in any one of the homes. And William Randolph Hearst is puppy dog gaga goo goo over her. He's always around too. Marion will explain the longest W.R. and I were ever separated was for 2 weeks in 1937. I was doing Cain and Mabel with Clark Gable and got held over for more scenes. Hearst never stopped courting Marion. She'll say, W.R. wrote little notes to me every day. He'd shove them under the door and wait until I woke up. He wouldn't allow anyone in the house to wake me up. I was spoiled. Oh, I love the spider webs. Marion will go on to say, because faithful to W.R., but everything happens. Marion is the center of this whole Hollywood universe. She'll say, I was supposed to be the matchmaker of Hollywood. I took great pleasure in promoting romances. I was always a bridesmaid and never the bride. Keep in mind, Marion said this after she wed for the very first and only time. We're getting to that story at the end. So this may or may not count in her book. Fun spiderweb, previous TD alum, Barbara Hutton, Marion remembers, was up there at another Hearst property called River House with Cary Grant just before they got married. She was very much in love with him. And I'm positive he was in love with her. He was very sweet with her, and he would say, how about a walk? Barbara doesn't like exercise at any time. I'm the same way. My exercise is going from chair to chair. She said, I don't feel like a walk. Cary said, well, let's just go a little way. They'd go off, and the next thing I'd see, he was carrying her in his arms. This incident birthed the nickname for the couple, Cash and Cary.
Yep.
Don't get me started on Cary Grant. Okay, moving on. What goes up must come down. According to the editors of Marion's memoir, While most of the world suffered through the years of the Great Depression, W.R. continued to buy whatever captured his fancy. Income from his business ventures was diverted to pay for his reconstructions at his various properties. The magazine Good Housekeeping held the title to his castle in Wales. As the Depression and the decade of the 30s continue on, which is not great for so many people, W.R., continuing his spree, can you imagine, becomes more and more unpopular with the public. Labor unions and problems began to afflict his publications. This is from Marion's memoir. At the beginning of 1938, W.R. was in very serious financial trouble. His investments in New York City real estate and his boundless appreciation of art had caused a monumental drain on the finances of his empire. By 1937, the year Marion retired, Hearst had amassed enormous debts. He was forced to place his empire into receivership and transfer his voting power over his stock to a former political advisor named Clarence J. Sherrn. Clarence J. Sherrn immediately begins liquidating art collections and real estate holdings and downsizing publications. But these cost-cutting measures were just a little too late. Hearst's empire was in desperate need of a cash infusion of $1 million.
A lot of money back then.
When Hearst's advisors call W.R. with the news, Marion answers the phone. Marion knows that his liquidity was practically zero at that point, so instead of passing on the message to her honey, Marion just called her business manager and bailed Hearst Empire out with her own personal funds. No problem.
Seems good.
Thanks for giving us a call. Give me 5 minutes. We're going to get some money sent over. Mm-hmm. By some reports, Marion gave WR a total of $5 million. This would be almost $90 million today. Marion, little trashy angel. Here's her quote. They were not smart. They didn't figure on me at all. They thought I was just a dullard, a stupid who sits in the corner with a dunce cap. Don't even mess with Marion Davies.
Yeah.
God, I love her.
So how does her boyfriend deal with her now owning his company?
I think they're okay with that.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and mention the Orson Welles film Citizen Kane. It is 4 years after Marion retires. She retires in 37, 1941, Citizen Kane, that RKO will release their film. Marion says, I never saw the picture of Citizen Kane, but my sister Rose did. And she said, I'll kill him, meaning Orson Welles. It's terrible. You can't even see the picture because it's all dark. Marion asks her sister Rose, why are you saying it's terrible? Rose says, it's against you. They have you playing and hiding behind curtains. Marion says, Rose, there's one tradition that I have that was taught to me by W.R. Never read criticism about yourself. Marion goes on, W.R. never went to see Citizen Kane either. The Hearst newspapers put a ban on it as far as publicity went, but W.R. wasn't little that way. His theory was that no matter what anybody said, no matter what they wrote, you didn't read it and you didn't listen. W.R. said, yesterday's newspaper is old news. But plenty of people talked about Citizen Kane. They would say that it was terrible and that I had to go see it. Hey, Mikey, do you drink this terrible
milk? Does this milk smell weird? Yeah.
But we never did. I had no anger toward Orson Welles. After all, everybody is created to do their very best. And he probably thought that was his way to make money. Who was I to say I didn't like the way he did his picture? I was not built that way. I liked to keep the waters calm. Keeping her side of the street clean, karma, Marion. Let's go ahead and talk about the end of the affair. 6 years after Citizen Kane was released, Marion Davies and W.R. Hearst left San Simeon for the last time. Hearst, at this point, his health is failing. He will pass away in Marion's Beverly Hills mansion in 1951 at the long-lived age of 88. When it does become clear that the end is near, Marion will welcome in W.R.'s sons into her home to sit vigil with their dying father.
Well, they've got to be in their 50s as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. 100%. Okay. Yeah.
I suspect they've all made their peace with each other by this point.
Well, you'd think they would have made their peace with Marion by this point, but that is not the way the story goes down.
Oh, okay.
Let's lay down some trash. So the sons come to sit vigil, and at some point, they convince Marion, who has done nothing but devote herself to the care of her lover, W.R., for years and years. Marion's exhausted. Hey, the boys are here. The sons say, hey, Marion, take this sedative. Why don't you just get some rest? You need some rest. Why don't you go to sleep? Marion does. W.R. dies in his sleep later that night. And as Marion sleeps, blissfully sleeps, those same sons had W.R.'s body removed from her house along with every trace of him. They do not leave a photograph behind.
Well, I don't approve of that sort of thing.
Marion Davies tells a reporter, I asked where he was and the nurse said he was dead. His body was gone and whoosh, just like that. Old W.R. was gone and the boys were gone. I was alone. Do you realize what they did? They stole a possession of mine. He belonged to me. I loved him for 32 years and now he was gone. I couldn't even say goodbye.
Yeah, that's not great.
Marion did not attend her funeral in San Francisco.
Mm.
She'll explain to another reporter, I thought I might go to church, but I'll just stay here. He knew how I felt about him, and I know how he felt about me. There's no need for dramatics.
Mm.
Marion Davies will live another 10 years and 39 days longer than her lover. The editors of her memoir will sum up Marion's life after Hearst thusly. After his death in 1951, although she was a lonely 54, it seems her life lost its momentum. She dabbled in real estate and built her fortune to an estimated value of $20 million, then wavered between constructive charities and destructive drinking. All those sons making nice with Marion, remember, for all those years. At that point, after the death of W.R., her sons cut off almost all contact with her. Most of, at this point, Marion's family had passed away. Many of the friends that she had entertained so graciously and so generously through the years drifted away now that the party was over. Marion did continue her philanthropy. She will establish a children's wing at UCLA's hospital. But sadly, Marion was more alone than she'd ever been in her life. She's had the constant companionship of W.R., even if they're not talking.
Sure.
For
30...
Yeah. 35 years?
Yeah.
Sometimes loneliness and grief makes one do some interesting things.
Because you mentioned that she did get married.
She does. 10 weeks after W.R. dies, Marion elopes to Las Vegas with Horace Brown. Horace Brown is a former captain in the Merchant Marines who bore more than a passing resemblance to W.R. Hearst. Now, the thing about this relationship that's unusual, Marion files for divorce several times from Horace Brown, but they never complete that process. She will stay married to Brown until her death in 1961 at the age of 64. Let's go ahead. I want to give Marion the final word here, even though she's had so much of the word in this particular story. In 1951, the same year that Hearst died, Marion Davies begins recording notes for her own memoir. Ultimately, though, she'll abandon this project, deciding to withhold the tapes until after her death for fear that maybe she revealed too much. I don't want this coming out in my lifetime exactly, but I am going to tell you the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Though she does directly address the urban legends swirling around the death of Thomas Ince, Marion acknowledged the most delectable piece of trash candy very obliquely, saying, the rumor about my having children has come up many times. Of course, I was working all the time, then on stage and in pictures. It's a little bit of shade here, but what Marion doesn't mention was that many people suspected her niece and constant companion, Patricia, was in fact
her daughter.
Marion and Hearst's love child. Now, Patricia herself doesn't mention this rumor until about 10 hours before Patricia's own death in 1993.
Yikes.
When she confessed what she believed to be the truth of her parentage to her own child. Long kept secrets.
Mm-hmm. And what is her? Does she believe she is their love child or was their love child?
Patricia did.
Okay.
Now, as far as we can tell, the Hearst estate, at least, continues to deny all of this rumor. And Patricia's family hasn't offered any independent confirmation. For what it's worth, Patricia was born June 8th, 1919. Marion Davies starred in 4 major productions that year, which would have made hiding a pregnancy pretty incredible if she was going to do it.
But was it the basketball story and a film called Large Purses?
There's a reason we're putting you in all those Tudor dresses. There is a little bit more follow-up. I may go ahead and do a Patreon spiderwebs about that this week. There's so much in this story. It was hard to kind of narrow down what to keep and maybe what to follow up on. In remembering her affair with Hearst after his death, Marion said, "I had plenty of opportunities to get married myself. But how can you marry someone when you're in love with somebody else? I couldn't think of anybody else when I was in love. Whether I could get married or not, I didn't particularly care. How could I break myself away from love just to say that I was a married woman? That meant nothing to me. I thought love and companionship were much more important. That's exactly what it was, companionship and devoted love. That was our pact." Sadly, though, I think Marion does pay for that pact. Film historian Jeannie Bassinger will write in her book Silent Stars, "Although the critics often gave her excellent notices, they never forgave her for the sin of William Randolph Hearst."
No, and it sounds like W.R. poisoned the well a bit with his own sons.
Poisoned the well in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
A love affair for the ages, those two. There's your May, December, nary a trashy divorce in our triangle, but they had their something going on, and I don't think I was misleading you. There was 5,000 square feet of spider webs in that one, right?
Yeah, and Google is telling me that Millicent lived until 1974.
Yes.
So there never was a window where W.R. was a widower, where he was eligible to be married. I mean, obviously, I suppose divorce laws had probably changed between 1930 or whatever, but never happened.
W.R., Backstage Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
When do you have a type? You gotta type.
Gotta type.
Goodness, that was a love affair for the ages, Marion and W.R. I can't thank you all enough for tuning into this one. We really do appreciate you spending your time with us, telling your friends about us, all the ways you support our endeavors. For Trashy Divorces, folks, Stacy, you're coming back this Wednesday, getting back to the divorces part of the brand.
Yeah, a very contemporary situation.
For my Done and Done investigators, do stay tuned. I got a few follow-up drops that I guarantee are going to knock your socks off. I'm really excited about sharing some of these scandalous stories with you as it pertains to our man, Dominic Dunn. Friends, thanks again for tuning in. We want y'all to have the most incredible week until we meet again, whenever and wherever we do.
Keep your hands clean, friends.
Keep your hearts trashy.
Mm-hmm.
And also, stay curious.
Keep on investigating.
That's exactly right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Big love.
Thanks for listening to the Done and Done podcast, a Hemlock Creatives production. You can email us at doneanddone@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Done and Done Podcast. For further information about our episodes or sources, you can find us online at www.doneanddone.com. See you next week, friends.